or 0 degrees Kelvin, absolute zero. This state is achieved when no heat energy remains within a substance. The motion of atoms and fundamental particles is as low as it can be. Temperature itself is a measure of atomic motion. At room temperature, for example, atoms move at the speed of a jet plane, but over tiny distances. Though absolute zero has yet to be achieved in a laboratory, physicists at MIT got pretty close when they cooled sodium gas to within 450 billionths of a degree. This or that. Speaking of pigeons, legend has it that when told of the significance of the discovery, Robert Wilson remarked, "We've either detected a pile of bird shit or the origin of the universe."
Surprise number two, the message in the microwaves. Think for a moment about where the cosmic microwaves came from. You may recall that about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe had cooled to the point that atoms could survive, and that before this time, the matter in the expanding universe was in the form of a plasma, enshrouding all radiation. When atoms formed, the universe became transparent, and all electromagnetic waves were liberated. Since then, the expansion of space has stretched out those waves, cooling the universe to a temperature that emits microwaves. The cosmic microwave background, then, is a time conduit to the state of the universe when atoms formed. And this brings us to a surprising fact. It turns out that no matter which direction we look into the cosmos, the temperature of the CMB is the same to one part in 10,000. The entire universe cannot all have a uniform temperature if the entire universe was not in thermal contact with itself. The temperatures from room to room within your fully temperature-controlled home vary by more than this. I don't care how big your home is, it's much, much smaller than the universe. This is where temperature begins to tell us about the age and also the size of the universe. The CMB traces back to the formation of the universe. The 380,000 years between the Big Bang itself and the formation of atoms would have offered plenty of time for any two parts of the universe to cool at slightly different rates, reaching different temperatures from one another. How then can the entire universe know what temperature it should be and match that temperature so precisely everywhere? The fact that it's all the same temperature strongly suggests that the universe spent much less time expanding than supposed. We call this the horizon problem, and we will need the inflationary model of the universe to help explain it. Surprise number three, the inflationary universe. Elementary particle physics is arguably one of the most important developments in modern science, and it becomes critical to our quest to know the age of the universe. Once upon a time, our newborn universe was so hot that violent collisions broke matter down into its most fundamental forms. The interactions between these elementary bits of matter marked the first step in its evolution. Thus, to understand the biggest thing we know, the observable universe, we must understand the smallest things we know, elementary particles. One of the earliest breakthroughs in the study of this kind of cosmology occurred in 1979, when American physicist Alan Guth and others developed what has come to be called the inflationary universe, named at a time when the inflation rate for the U.S. economy exceeded 10%. Inflationary cosmology is still being explored and developed, but selected features worked swimmingly. Applying a modern understanding of particle physics, Guth discovered that when the universe was 10 to the negative 35 seconds old, it froze. Freezing is a familiar form of phase change. We know that some materials, such as water, expand slightly when going from liquid to solid. This is why water pipes burst if they are not protected during a cold snap. Guth found that the universe could also expand stupendously as it went through this particular inflationary phase transition, an expansion of space itself. Intriguing. But the hypothesis also tells us that before inflation, the universe was much smaller than you would expect just by playing the film backward from the Hubble expansion. In this pre-inflation period, the universe was tiny, making it trivial for all its parts to come into thermal equilibrium and achieve the same temperature. Once established, this uniformity of temperature would remain imprinted everywhere across the universe during the subsequent period of rapid expansion. Not only that, but large fluctuations also flatten out and become small fluctuations during rapid expansion. So the inflationary model not only explains why the large-scale universe is at the same temperature with itself, but also why the temperature fluctuations themselves are so small, thus solving the horizon problem.
One part in 10,000. To get some idea of what it means for two measurements to vary by less than one part in 10,000, imagine two yardsticks, each purporting to be accurate. If, when you lay them side by side to compare, one is longer than the other by less than the width of a human hair, then they differ by less than one part in 10,000.
Surprise number four, temperature differences in the CMB. To understand the importance of small yet detectable differences in the CMB, we have to remember what the universe was like before the formation of atoms. All matter was in the form of a plasma, with charged particles like protons and electrons bobbing around a sea of electromagnetic radiation. The moment matter attempted to clump together, the high-energy radiation blew the concentration apart. Each event like this produced a wave in the plasma. Because of their similarity to sound waves in the air, these waves are often called acoustic waves or acoustic oscillations. The plasma naturally lumped up in some regions more than others. The waves formed a complex pattern in the plasma, with more complexity generated within regions of higher density, such as what you would see if you threw a handful of gravel into a still pond. These patterns propagated through the plasma until atoms formed and the radiation was released. Meanwhile, the radiation was imprinted with these patterns and thus froze into the structure of the universe. The regions of high density, dark matter included, seeded the formation of galaxies. This is why studies of where galaxies are in the universe, together with a detailed temperature map of the CMB, can help us disentangle and decode the history of the universe on our way to finding out how old it is. Data from the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, which measured temperature variations in the CMB using the best instruments available, combined with data from galaxy surveys, give us a reliable age of the universe, 13.8 billion years. But don't get too comfortable with that solution. There's another way to measure the age of the universe, and it doesn't agree with that one.
A tweet. The cosmos. 13.8 billion years in the making. Small numbers. The number we have written as 10 to the minus 35 seconds, the age of the universe at this key moment of inflation, is a decimal point followed by 35 zeros and a 1. 0. 0.000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 everything in our experience. For reference, the world's fastest computer completes calculations in about 10 to the minus 18 seconds, an eternity compared to the age of the universe when inflation occurred.
The Astronomical Distance Ladder. The CMB gives us one way to find the age and size of the universe. As often happens in science, however, there are other completely independent ways of answering the same question. These alternate techniques provide a valuable check on our assumptions and our measurements because they depend on different properties of the universe. In an ideal world, of course, all methods will yield the same result for every measurement. One alternative way to measure the age of the universe depends on its large-scale structure. Unfortunately, this technique runs into one of the most persistent challenges astrophysicists face: finding the distance to astronomical objects. Think of the last time you looked at the stars. One that appears faint might be close and dim, but it could also be highly luminous yet far away. Here we must return to our distance ladder. Suppose you want to measure how far away something is. If we're talking about a table or a room in your house, an ordinary yardstick would probably suffice. On the other hand, if we're talking about the size of your city, you would probably want another instrument, perhaps the odometer in your car. In the same way, if you wanted to find the distance to a city on another continent, you might want to use satellite data. Depending on the distance you want to measure, you need to use a different scale of rulers, a different satchel of tools, a different rung on the distance ladder. And ideally, you would find or establish regions where the different measurement strategies overlap. That's where you make sure the two different techniques give the same result. We must ensure that different parts of the ladder join correctly. We have already encountered the first two rungs of this astronomical ladder. The simplest way to calculate distance is by triangulation, or parallax. Measuring the angle of the lines of sight to a distant object, together with some simple geometry, allows us to know how far an object is from us. The Gaia satellite, launched in 2013 by the ESA, with its hundreds of millions of stellar parallax measurements, has extended this first rung of the distance ladder out to about 25,000 light-years, and it included Cepheid variable stars. Onto these forms of measurement, we graft Henrietta Leavitt's standard candle method, which gets us out to other galaxies. But at a distance out of about 100 million light-years, we are no longer able to distinguish individual stars in distant galaxies, and we must find a new kind of measuring stick, a new standard candle, for measuring the universe's size and ultimately learning its age. Surprise number 5, dark energy. The best way to extend the distance ladder, to add a third rung, is to find another standard candle, but one that can be seen at greater distances. Fortunately, nature has provided just such an object. It's called a Type 1A supernova. These supernovae occur only in double star systems, where two stars orbit each other, and one of the partners is a white dwarf. White dwarfs, though equal in mass to our sun, are a million times smaller, and therefore a million times more dense. The white dwarf pulls material from its partner until its mass nears 1.4 times that of the sun. At this Chandrasekhar limit, named after Indian-American astrophysicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar, pressures ignite a series of thermonuclear reactions that quite literally blow the white dwarf apart. For a few weeks, the supernova can shine more brightly than the entire galaxy in which it's embedded, and since all Type 1A supernovae are exploding white dwarfs of approximately equal mass, their brightness profiles are all the same, fortuitously becoming a standard candle that is visible to great distances. Starting in the 1990s, astrophysicists began using Type 1A supernova standard candles to investigate the history of the Hubble expansion. Everyone expected the expanding universe to be slowing because of the collective gravitational force of all its constituents and galaxies. As these things sometimes go, just the opposite was seen. Distant galaxies were dimmer, in other words, farther away than expected, which means the expansion of the universe was speeding up. An unexpected pressure filling all of space must be pushing the galaxies apart against their wishes. American astrophysicist Michael Turner coined the placeholder term dark energy to describe whatever it is that's causing it. By the way, dark matter pulls matter together, whereas dark energy pushes it apart. So despite their similarity in names, we're given no reason to think that dark matter and dark energy are at all related. As we shall see in the next section, a full understanding of CMB data requires the existence of dark energy, a linchpin in the fate of the universe. Even so, we have no idea what dark energy is. Astrophysicists Adam Riess, Saul Perlmutter, and Brian Schmidt, who conducted the Deep Universe supernova studies that spawned this discovery, received the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics for their work. But wait, there's more. Using this new rung in the distance ladder, a team led by Adam Riess, after pushing the Hubble Space Telescope to the limits of its capabilities, uncovered our next big surprise. They reported a current expansion rate that corresponds to a 12.5 billion year age of the universe, younger than the 13.8 billion years obtained from CMB data. The difference doesn't seem like much. What's a billion years between friends? Problem is, both measurements have high accuracy and excellent precision granted by their own methods and tools. Their margins of error do not overlap, but they both cannot be right. So either one is wrong and the other is right, or both are wrong. Now what?
A tweet. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics went to the discoverers of dark energy. For once, a finding bigger than the prize itself.
The tension. We now confront two different ways to estimate the age of the universe. Against all expectations, the two methods report different results. 13.8 billion years from the CMB analysis, 12.5 billion years from the distance ladder extension. The tension between these two compelling solutions can soften upon citing a simple fact. There is no such thing as a perfect measurement. No matter how precisely something is measured, there is always a limit to how accurately a result can be known. Suppose you wanted to measure the size of the room you are in right now. You would probably use a ruler or a tape measure to do the job. No matter how careful you are, however, there is a fundamental limit to how accurately you can make the measurement. An American ruler illustrates this well. On it, there will be a smallest interval, typically 1/16th of an inch. If you use a ruler divided this way, there is no way to tell whether the room is 10 feet 5/32nds of an inch or 10 feet 6/32nds of an inch long. And if your ruler were graded in 1/32nds of an inch intervals, you would not know if your room were 10 feet 11/64ths of an inch or 10 feet 12/64ths of an inch long. There is, in other words, a fundamental limit on how accurately you can know the dimensions of your room, and therefore a quantifiable uncertainty in your experiment. What about measuring the size of a continent? The continent ends at the shore, but what is the shore? The waterline ebbs and flows. Even the exact measurement of low tide is never replicated. Because of the moon's varying distance from Earth and Earth's varying distance from the sun, some low tides are lower than others. At some point, everyone must agree on a number that is close enough. No matter how accurate your apparatus, no matter how carefully you observe, your measuring equipment will always involve a smallest interval, and consequently, an uncertainty in your last decimal place. In science, this uncertainty represents the range of values the experiment might produce, if performed multiple times. When you measured your room, you might report a length of plus or minus 1/16th of an inch to account for that uncertainty on your ruler. The size of the measuring scale is only one of many sources of uncertainty in real experiments and observations. Sometimes there is an undetected flaw in the equipment that has nothing to do with the measurement stick. For example, in 2011, physicists at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, announced the detection of a particle that traveled faster than light. Had it been true, this result would require a major reworking of Einstein's theory of relativity. But in the end, a badly connected fiber optic cable was to blame. In this case, the limit on accuracy was set by a problem in the apparatus, and not by any uncertainties in measurement. This is not uncommon and explains why Penzias and Wilson spent so much time troubleshooting their apparatus before announcing the discovery of the CMB. Sometimes the uncertainties are purely statistical. If you want to estimate the average height of your country's population and measure only 10 people on the day a basketball team comes through town, you can expect results of low accuracy. Pollsters know this. That's why they try to reach 1,000 people and not just 10. Even then, their margin of error is typically plus or minus 3%. Measure 1,000,000 people from the same population, and both accuracy and precision improve. Uncertainty can also arise because of mistakes in the analysis of measurements. If you thought your ruler, purchased in the United States, was measuring in yards, when it was actually measuring in meters, which are 9% longer, your answer would be off by 9%, regardless of how precisely you measured. Similarly, an unknown background effect. If the room you measured didn't have straight walls, for example, and you didn't know it, can mean your results will be wrong no matter what. No doubt about it, conducting good science is messy business. When the two different ages of the universe obtained by the two different methods first reared their heads several years ago, scientists paid little mind. At that time, both measurements had large uncertainties, and more to the point, those uncertainties overlapped, meaning the universe could have an age somewhere in that overlapping range. As time went on, however, both groups improved, that is, reduced their uncertainties, and the difference could no longer be ignored. The CMB age is now quoted as 13.799 plus or minus 0.021 billion years, while the supernova age is 12.5 plus or minus 0.3 billion years. If the tiny uncertainties offer no place to meet in the middle, then this discrepancy is likely due to some unknown effect in the analysis of the various measurements. In the words of Adam Riess, this mismatch has been growing and has now reached a point that is really impossible to dismiss as a fluke.
A tweet. Don't give up on us yet. Americans are inching towards the metric system. The right question. If two highly reliable measurements of the same phenomenon give two different answers, and if that difference appears to be reproducibly intractable, even after all assumptions were tested and retested, and after all experiments were verified and re-verified by scientific allies as well as competitors, then there's a chance the question that spawned the measurement might not have the meaning you think it should. What is the temperature of love? Where is the edge of Earth's surface? What kind of cheese is the moon made of? All of these questions are legitimate English language sentences with nouns and verbs in the right places, but they have no physical meaning because the very questions themselves are flawed. Could "How old is the universe?" be one of those questions, and we don't yet know it? A tweet. Unlike the ether, hypothesized but never detected, dark energy is a measured entity. We just remain clueless what it is. Accuracy versus precision. A digital clock that displays time to 1/100th of a second is precise. In fact, it's more precise than most people will ever require in their lives. But suppose, just suppose, the clock was 6 minutes fast and you did not know it. That would be a highly precise but wholly inaccurate clock. In science, we first seek accuracy. Is the answer right at all? Is it in the ballpark? Next, we try to improve on that accuracy by making the measurements more and more precise.
Surprise number 6. Dark matter. Up to this point in our quest for the size and age of the universe, we have been talking mostly about familiar forms of matter, such as the protons and other particles found in your everyday atoms. You can, in fact, think of the entire history of science as an attempt to understand the properties of ordinary matter. But we would ultimately learn more was hiding in the universe than meets the eye. Beginning in the 1930s, astronomers found clusters of galaxies that seemed to be held together more strongly than could be explained by the gravitational attraction of their visible matter. And in the 1970s, American astrophysicist Vera Rubin found the same phenomenon within galaxies themselves. Stars in orbit around a galactic center were moving much faster than they ought to, given the gravity of all the stars present and accounted for. The only way to explain this result was to assume that the entire visible galaxy, the part made of familiar matter, was encased in a huge sphere of mysterious material that exerted a gravitational force but did not radiate or interact with electromagnetic waves. This material was dubbed dark matter. In the half century since Rubin's measurements, evidence for dark matter has been verified in many different cosmic environments, and it turns out to be crucial to our understanding of how galaxies form, itself vital to understanding the age and size of the universe. We can, in fact, characterize the state of our knowledge of dark matter as follows. We know it exists. We have no idea what it is. Perhaps it should instead be called dark gravity.
A tweet. Add up all we know about matter and energy, and it accounts for less than 5% of what drives the universe. What we call dark matter and dark energy comprise the rest, yet we know nothing of them other than they exist, leaving the astrophysicist delightfully befuddled for now.
Formations of the universe. It's difficult to see the universe in three dimensions, which is, of course, essential to knowing its size. Our first attempt to develop a comprehensive 3D picture of galaxies across space was through redshift surveys. We already know where a galaxy resides on the 2D sky. But after we know a galaxy's redshift, the velocity at which it moves away from us, we then employ Hubble's law to calculate the distance to the galaxy, completing our knowledge of its cosmic location in three dimensions. Modern surveys can take advantage of advanced electronics and measure redshifts of hundreds of galaxies at a time. Consequently, modern redshift surveys are much more comprehensive than their predecessors. In 1982, Harvard's Center for Astrophysics used redshift survey techniques and cataloged 2,200 galaxies. By 2007, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, thanks to advancing technology, published redshifts for more than a million galaxies, offering an ever more comprehensive three-dimensional picture. When you lay out where all these galaxies are in space, they are not evenly spaced across the cosmos. Instead, a strangely ordered universe reveals itself. Imagine you have a huge sponge and a big knife. If you use the knife to slice through the sponge, you will see pockets of empty volumes bordered by a sponge. In the same way, when we look at redshift surveys, we find empty spaces, sensibly called voids, surrounded by thread-like filaments and sheets whose structural elements are galaxies. Welcome to the large-scale structure of the universe. To illustrate our place in this grand assemblage, and to answer the intertwining questions, how big is the universe and how old is the universe along the way, consider this. Earth is part of the solar system, and the Sun is part of the Milky Way galaxy, a structure some 100,000 light-years across. The Milky Way, in turn, is part of the local group of galaxies, a structure some 2 million light-years across. The local group is part of a Virgo supercluster of galaxies some 750 million light-years across. Finally, this supercluster is part of the web of structures surrounding the voids previously described. A long-earned but nonetheless powerful indication that the shape and form and contents of the universe are knowable, not only in the here and now, but also in the there and then.
The Lux experiment. If the Milky Way is indeed encased in a sphere of dark matter, then the motion of Earth should create a wind of dark matter particles continually sweeping through and around us. Because dark matter appears to interact only through the relatively weak force of gravity, This wind will interact very seldom with ordinary matter, most of the time just passing through without a trace. In the Sanford Laboratory, located a mile underground in an old South Dakota gold mine, a phone booth-sized container of liquid xenon has been outfitted to detect any rare collisions between the dark matter wind and the xenon atoms. This is the centerpiece of the LUX, Large Underground Xenon Experiment. As of this writing, no dark matter particles have been detected in this or any other experiment. A tweet. Nothing to tweet today, except for all those who wanted more space. The universe continues to expand at about 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. The Great Wall. The largest structure detected in the observable universe is a supercluster of galaxies called the Boss Great Wall, named for the study that spotted it, the Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey. This enormous cosmic webbing spans a billion light years and looks like a grand honeycomb.
Chapter 5. What is the universe made of? The birth of chemistry. Where did the elements come from? The new atomic theory. Disassembling the atom. Who ordered that? The coming of the accelerators. The coming of the quarks. Glossary of particle physics. Are there even more layers? 5. The quest to uncover answers to one of the most fundamental questions in science can begin by simply looking around you. A superficial peek gives the impression of a universe made from a zillion different materials, each different and distinct, obeying a bazillion different rules. Suppose someone asks you to define the basic building block from which libraries are made. From the outside, it's clearly made of bricks or some other sturdy construction material. But if you manage to open the front doors and go inside, you will see shelf after shelf of books. So your second response might be that books are the basic building blocks of libraries. But a library is not just a random pile of books. Classification schemes tell you how the books are arranged. Biography, poetry, fiction, and so on. As you probe deeper, you must continue to modify your answer to the question about the basic building blocks of libraries. Now, pick any book off any shelf, open it, and you see a collection of words. Nearly all the books, in fact, are made up of words, so we have to change our answer to say that the basic building block is the word. And there is a set of rules called grammar that tells us how to combine words into sentences, sentences into paragraphs, paragraphs into chapters, and all those ultimately into books. But wait. There's yet another layer to be revealed. Some words and word combinations appear in the books of some libraries and not in others, revealing the existence of languages in the world and perhaps specialized libraries. And for most languages, we quickly discover that words are made from letters assembled according to rules of spelling that tell us how to combine letters into words. Further, in our digital age, we could also go down one more layer and represent letters by a string of zeros and ones, with a corresponding rule that tells us how to sequence the zeros and ones to make letters. So, our question about the basic structure of libraries leads us down a rabbit hole to a picture far more complex than we might have first anticipated or even imagined. Our search for the basic structure of the universe does the same.
A tweet. Some of my best friends, actually all of my best friends, are made of chemicals.
The birth of chemistry. During the Middle Ages, a group of researchers pursued a field they called alchemy. In the popular imagery, they often look like Merlin proteges or refugees from a Harry Potter movie. Indeed, some of the more unscrupulous members of the profession got wealthy by promising their patrons they would find ways to turn base lead into precious gold. False promises notwithstanding, the alchemists contributed to scientific progress, and over the centuries accumulated scads of qualitative information about chemical reactions. All this knowledge landed on a scientific footing with Antoine Lavoisier and his wife Marie-Anne Lavoisier, members of 18th-century French nobility. They introduced precision measurement into chemistry, and Antoine was the first to show that the total mass in a chemical reaction does not change, which became the law of conservation of mass. From our point of view, however, Lavoisier's most important discovery was that such a thing as elements exist at all. There may be countless kinds of materials in the world, but most of them can be broken down into smaller constituents by chemical means. Burn wood or dissolve a metal alloy in acid, and you transform the metamaterials into base ingredients. Some materials, however, cannot break down in this way. The black carbon that is left when wood burns, for example, can be combined with other materials to make something more complicated like carbon dioxide, but it cannot be broken down into anything simpler. Carbon, then, is an example of what we call a chemical element. Although chemists at the time knew thousands of different materials, they knew only a few elements. In 1776, for example, a year familiar to Americans, among all cataloged substances, only 22 pure elements were known, 12 of which had been identified by the ancients. By the end of the 18th century, chemists recognized some astonishing regularities among the chemical elements. One of the most important of these is the law of multiple proportions, which states that the relative weights of different elements in a given material will always be the same, no matter where the material comes from. The weight of oxygen to hydrogen in water, for example, will always be 8:1, whether the water comes from a tropical island or a melting glacier. With this arsenal of discoveries, scientists were poised to go ever deeper into the question of what the universe was made of.
A tweet. Sometimes I wonder whether the universe can make something more complex than itself. Genius Interrupted. Unfortunately, Antoine Lavoisier did not live to participate further in the science of his generation. A bad time in France to be a member of the nobility and to be a scientist. Plus, he was connected to an unpopular tax collection company. Lavoisier was sent to the guillotine in 1794 during the French Revolution's reign of terror. Pleas for leniency are said to have come from all over Europe, with no success. Fellow astronomer Joseph Louis Lagrange lamented, "It took them only an instant to cut off that head, and 100 years may not produce another like it."
Where did the elements come from? We know the number of protons in the atomic nucleus of each chemical element. We also know that the 3-minute-old universe briefly produced nuclei of atoms with up to 3 protons, hydrogen with 1, helium with 2, and lithium with 3. Where did all the other elements come from? To answer this question, one must return to the formation of the solar system. As gravity compresses the material into what will become the sun, the temperature in the core reaches millions of degrees, triggering nuclear fusion. After a few intermediate steps, 4 hydrogen nuclei fuse together to form a helium nucleus, as well as some miscellaneous particles plus energy. The sun then, like most stars, generates energy by converting hydrogen into helium. When nearing the end of its life, a star exhausts its supply of hydrogen in the core and contracts, briefly surrendering to the inexorable force of gravity. Temperatures in the condensing core rise further, enough for 3 helium nuclei, with 2 protons each, to fuse and form a carbon nucleus with 6 protons, along with its intended neutrons. Thus, the ashes of one nuclear fire serve as fuel for the next, empowering stars to forge elements heavier than those the young universe could. A star like the sun isn't massive enough to fuse nuclei past those of carbon. But via the solar wind, it casts some of its hard-earned elements into space. More massive stars, however, can continue fusing nuclei through carbon all the way up to iron with 26 protons. The ultimate nuclear ash, and the end of the line for nuclear fusion reactions that generate energy. The iron accumulates in the core of the star, but when the star tries to fuse iron, the nuclear reactions absorb energy. A bad situation. Stars are not in the business of absorbing energy. The star rapidly collapses under its own weight, with no source of energy to balance the impending disaster. The collapse spawns a titanic explosion we call a supernova. In the resulting maelstrom, with plenty of surplus energy to get the job done, elements all the way up to uranium, with 92 protons, are produced. Uranium is the heaviest naturally occurring element in the periodic table. All the rest, up to oganessen, element 118, named for Russian physicist Yuri Oganessian, have been produced only in laboratories. How? If you accelerate a heavy nucleus to high speed and let it collide with a target, the subsequent reshuffling of protons and neutrons might form a few atoms of a new element. For example, we have only ever produced 75 single atoms of copernicium, element 112, named for Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus, in our laboratories. The attempt to produce still more massive super-heavy elements remains a thriving cottage industry in the world of nuclear physics.
The Island of Stability. While the heaviest super-heavy elements produced in the laboratory typically decay in fractions of a second, nuclear theorists predict that when we finally produce element 126, we will reach a so-called island of stability, and thus herald a new class of chemical elements that might form the basis of a new kind of chemistry. 63. The number of chemical elements Mendeleev knew about. Today, it's 118 and counting.
The New Atomic Theory. John Dalton was an English schoolteacher whose first love was meteorology, a subject that included the study of chemical reactions in the atmosphere. In 1808, he introduced the modern atomic theory. In Greek, the word atom means that which cannot be divided, and indeed, Dalton thought of atoms as indivisible. He proposed that there was an atom corresponding to each chemical element. All the atoms of a given element are identical, and atoms of different elements are different from one another. In this plan, assortments of atoms combine to form the range and diversity of materials that comprise the natural and unnatural world. This explains why most materials can break down. It's just a matter of separating the atoms. Only then, Dalton argued, can you no longer take things apart. Dalton's model explained many of the features of materials, features that were constant, predictable, and recognized, but before that unexplainable. Water, for example, consists of one oxygen atom bound with two hydrogen atoms, no matter where it is found. A single oxygen atom weighs 8 times as much as 2 hydrogen atoms, so the 8-to-1 ratio in weight between the two was a simple feature of how atoms combine. As time went by, scientists continued to discover more chemical elements. A 19th-century Russian chemist, Dmitry Mendeleev, encountered the problem of organizing the known chemical elements while writing a textbook. The solution? Mendeleev created the modern periodic table of the elements. Still a standard icon in the chemistry classroom. The elements get heavier as you read from left to right in any row, and they have similar chemical properties if you read down any column. In his original table, he left some blank spaces to make things work. He expected that these spaces would be filled as new elements were discovered, and indeed, subsequent discoveries validated his ideas. Although scientists knew that the periodic table was a valid arrangement, they had no idea why it worked. Not until the 1920s and the discovery of quantum physics could a deep understanding of the table emerge.
A tweet. Some elements don't interact with others. Noble gases, the Brits called them, tainting the periodic table with their class system.
Disassembling the Atom. By the late 19th century, scientists uncovered a world of relative simplicity. A world where a small number of indivisible atoms, shuffled around in different combinations, produced the world that is immediately available to our senses. If complex materials are the books in our metaphorical library, atoms are the words filling the pages. This comfortable simplicity began to unravel in 1897 when the English physicist J.J. Thomson performed an experiment that revealed the existence of totally unexpected particles. Electrons, negatively charged constituents of matter that shake loose from atoms readily and easily. The problem was that Dalton's atomic theory, which held atoms to be indivisible, had no room for something like this. If an electron can rip apart from an atom is clearly divisible. For a while, theorists dealt with Thomson's result by picturing the atom as something like a raisin bun, an amorphous, positively charged material embedded with electrons. In 1911, however, New Zealand physicist Ernest Rutherford announced the results of an experiment that put an end to the idea and crafted our current understanding of the atom. Rutherford aimed a stream of particles, subatomic bullets, toward an extremely thin sheet of gold and observed how they scattered. Gold is the element of choice in this experience for how thin it can be hammered. In this case, just a few thousand atoms thin. If the atom were really like a raisin bun, this would be like a bullet fired at a cloud and effortlessly passing through. What Rutherford found was that only about a tenth of 1% of his subatomic bullets bounced back at him. If you shot a round of bullets through a cloud, and one of them came ricocheting back toward you, what might you assume? Something stronger than your bullet was lurking within that cloud. Similarly, the only explanation for Rutherford's unexpected result was that all of the mass of the atom was concentrated in a small structure at its center. A structure Rutherford called the nucleus, with the electrons in orbit around it. The particles that bounced back had hit the nucleus, while the others had simply passed through the mostly empty cloud of orbiting electrons. Rutherford called the nucleus of the hydrogen atom the proton, meaning first one. But he knew that heavier atoms had to have more than protons in their nuclei. The nucleus of the oxygen atom, for example, has 8 protons in its nucleus, but weighs 16 times as much as hydrogen. Rutherford predicted we would find another particle that had about the same mass as the proton, but no electric charge. He called this hypothetical particle the neutron, or neutral one. And that particle was indeed discovered in 1932 by British physicist James Chadwick. Once again, we find complexity reduced to simplicity. The universe was built from 3 particles, protons and neutrons, which make up the nuclei of atoms, and electrons in orbit around them. Atoms then combine to form all the materials we see. But this simplicity would not last. Even deeper layers of matter lurked just out of view.
An unconventional scientist. Ernest Rutherford is the only scientist we know of who did his most important work after he received the Nobel Prize. He got the prize in chemistry in 1908 for identifying some of the products of radioactive decay, an important advance, but not in the same category as discovering the structure of the atom, which happened later.
Who ordered that? The agents that destroyed the simple proton-neutron-electron picture of the universe came literally out of the sky. Earth is constantly bombarded by streams of particles called cosmic rays, mostly protons, mostly from the sun. These particles have energy high enough to penetrate and tear apart the nucleus of atoms in Earth's atmosphere. Examining the debris of such collisions opened a hidden door to the world inside the nucleus. This technique of probing the nucleus by examining the debris of particle collisions has been the main tool available to physicists since the early 20th century. The American physicist Richard Feynman likened the method to dropping a Swiss watch off the Empire State Building and then trying to figure out how the watch worked by looking at the pieces on the sidewalk. Sounds messy and clumsy, but you had no other way of looking inside the watch. By the 1930s, physicists devised a method to harness cosmic rays for this purpose. Physicists deployed detectors at laboratories on mountaintops, such as Pike's Peak in Colorado, where they intercepted the incoming cosmic rays to track their interactions. And that's when the confusion began. Unexpected things started showing up in the cosmic ray experiments. First, there was a particle with the same mass as the electron, but a positive electrical charge, the first example of antimatter, aptly named the positron. Then there was a particle like the electron, but 200 times heavier, and living much longer than it should have. With a half-life of only 1.5 microseconds, it should not have been able to reach Earth's surface. This unexpected particle, named the muon, famously prompted American physicist I.I. Robbie to voice the plaintive cry, "Who ordered that?" The list grew. Protons have nearly 2,000 times the mass of electrons. Yet researchers found brand new particles with a mass between protons and electrons and called them mesons, after the Greek mesos for middle. They found particles even heavier than protons and called them hyperons. After physicists built particle accelerators with controllable collisions, they no longer needed to rely on random pulses of gamma rays from space. And the list of particles grew even longer. Most of the new particles existed so briefly that they could barely get from one side of the atomic nucleus to the other before disintegrating. Clearly, the nucleus is not the passive bag of marbles labeled proton and neutron that scientists once thought, but rather a seething cauldron of myriad short-lived particles. Physicists had opened a whole new box of mysteries, yet another layer of organization in the universe. The coming of the accelerators. To study the interior of the nucleus, we need very high-speed tools to smash them and very high-precision means to analyze the train wreck. Cosmic rays provided these probes to us for free. Their great disadvantage, however, is our inability to control either the energy or the time of arrival. Particle accelerators granted us the freedom to manufacture and control our own probes. The history of accelerators begins in the 1930s with Ernest Lawrence at University of California, Berkeley, where he developed one of the first particle accelerators, the cyclotron. Particle accelerators like cyclotrons depend on a key property of elementary particles. Inject a moving, electrically charged particle into a magnetic field, and the path of the particle curves around, eventually forming a circle. Lawrence realized that if you start with a magnet, slice it through the middle, and separate the two pieces by a small gap, he could accelerate positively charged protons as they pass through the gap, propelled by the force of the magnets, thus forming a proton beam that could be fired at a target. Lawrence's first cyclotron would fit in the palm of your hand. By the 1950s, though, the Berkeley cyclotrons had grown to the size of a sports arena. The next step in accelerators was the synchrotron. Instead of a single massive magnet, these machines configure a series of long curved magnets in a ring. The circle can be yards or even miles in circumference. The particles accelerate along an evacuated path, and then the strength of the magnets can be actively adjusted to keep the faster moving particles in the vacuum chamber. The Large Hadron Collider, LHC, the largest accelerator in the world today, is located near Geneva, Switzerland. The word hadron refers to any of the particles you might find in the nucleus of the atom. With a vacuum chamber about 17 miles, 27 kilometers around, the accelerator is buried underground to shield those living above the tunnels from any harmful radiation. The Large Hadron Collider is not one, but two synchrotrons, with one proton beam traveling clockwise, the other traveling counterclockwise. The two beams can collide at specific points to exploit the double kinetic energy available in head-on collisions. In the spray of particles created by these collisions, physicists uncloak that next level in the eternal quest to know the structure of matter in the universe.
A tweet. Top four collaborations of nations. 1. The waging of war. 2. International Space Station. 3. Large Hadron Collider. 4. Olympics. $25. The cost of the first cyclotron Lawrence built at Berkeley. About $450 today. $4,750,000,000. The cost to build the Large Hadron Collider.
The coming of the quarks. When scientists introduce a new concept, they choose between two naming strategies. They can take an existing word and give it a new meaning, for example, the word work, which has a precise meaning in physics not reflected in everyday usage. Alternatively, scientists can invent a new word completely, which is just what physicists did when they opened the next door. By the late 1960s, elementary particles had proliferated. One group of physicists at Berkeley maintained a register of reported particles and periodically published a summary tome describing the hundreds of known particles. So jaded did some members of the physics community get that an editorial in a prominent physics journal declared that if all you've got to report is a new particle, don't send the manuscript to us. They weren't interested. Even Enrico Fermi, the creator of the world's first nuclear reactor, said, "If I could remember the names of these particles, I would have become a botanist." The physicists' search for simplicity had led to a world of complexity. It came as a great relief, then, when the American physicists Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig showed that the proliferation of particles could be explained simply if we went one more layer down. They showed that all the elementary particles could be thought of as combinations of three particles that were more elementary still. Gell-Mann named these particles quarks, a tip of the hat to a line of wordplay in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. Three quarks for Muster Mark. The idea was that different combinations of these quarks correspond to different principles in the particle zoo, just as different combinations of atoms produced different materials in Dalton's atomic theory. These three quarks are whimsically called up, down, and strange. Unlike the elementary particles, however, they have fractional electrical charges. Two-thirds or one-third of the charge of the electron or proton. Subsequent experiments have shown that there are actually six quarks in nature, though the original word remains, and Finnegan's Wake has not been revised. In the beginning, scientists searched strenuously to find free quarks in nature or to produce them at accelerators. When these searches failed, theorists realized that once quarks lock into a particle, they're stuck for good. A property called quark confinement. Here's how it works. Try to pull two quarks apart, and, like stretching a rubber band, doing so feeds energy to the system. Eventually, you succeed in breaking their bond, but the energy you invested to accomplish this task is exactly the energy necessary for E equals mc squared to create two more quarks, one for each freshly broken bond. Today, the six-quark model is fundamental to our ideas about the structure of matter and marks the deepest layer we have yet to reveal in the operations of nature. But the inevitable question remains, is there yet another layer?
What next? The next big project for particle accelerators is the International Linear Collider, ILC. As the name implies, this machine will accelerate beams of electrons and positrons down long, straight tubes, allowing them to collide head-on when they reach maximum energy. The machine will be long, about the distance you would run in a marathon. No cost estimates have been made at this point.
Glossary of Particle Physics. Once we get into the weeds with elementary particles, we start running into a lot of strange and whimsical words. We assure you, these are all perfectly scientific. Hadron. Any of the hundreds of particles that can exist inside the atomic nucleus. The word means strongly interacting ones. The most familiar hadrons are the proton and neutron. Baryon. Hadrons that, like the proton and neutron, are made from three quarks. The word means heavy ones. Meson. Hadrons that are made from a quark-antiquark pair. The name means intermediate one. The first mesons discovered were intermediate in mass between protons and neutrons. Lepton. An elementary particle not normally found in the nucleus. The name means weakly interacting one. The most familiar lepton is the electron. There are six leptons, the electron and two other more massive particles like it, and three types of neutrinos. Neutrino. A lepton that has no electric charge and almost no mass. The name means little neutral one. Neutrinos are copiously produced in nuclear reactions in stars, and depicting them has been a major activity in modern astrophysics. There are three different types of neutrinos, corresponding to the three masses of leptons described previously. Up and down quarks. The quarks that make up protons and neutrons. Quark color. A property of quarks roughly analogous to electrical charge. A quark can have any of three possible color charges, typically referred to as red, green, and blue. In spectra, these three colors combine to make white light. Particles have to be made of combinations of quarks whose color charges add up to white. Quark flavor designates which kind of quark we are talking about. The up and down quarks, for example, have different flavors. Gluon. A particle that, when exchanged between quarks, generates the force that holds quarks together in particles. Like quarks, gluons carry the color charge. Strangeness. A property of the strange quark that is roughly analogous to electrical charge. One of its effects is to slow down the decay of particles that contain this particular quark. Charm. A property with the same effect as strangeness, but specific to charm quarks. Bottom and top. Properties with the same effect as strangeness and charm, but specific to bottom and top quarks. Are there even more layers? Are quarks really the end of the story about the basic structure of the universe? Have we arrived at the zeros and ones of the cosmos? The very frontiers of theoretical physics seek to answer this question. Two approaches in that field lead us to the next step. If there is